I'm extremely pleased to introduce Mary Menton. I know many of you already know her. For those of you who don't, she's currently a senior or a fellow at the University of Birmingham and also co-founder of SEED, a partnership that does research on environmental development. She is going to discuss just a small matter of power and politics in the Amazon today. but fortunately is really well positioned to do that, has for the next 17 years experience doing research, a lot of field research as well in Brazil and Peru. So I think without further ado, I'll hand the floor over.
Thanks. Thank you all for being here. So I am going to tackle the very small topic of governing the Amazon. I went out on a little bit of a limb with this because some of these ideas are still developing. So I really would like feedback and critique and your thoughts on the matter, because it's maybe a little less polished than I had expected it to be. I suppose it's always the case. But these are sort of ideas in formation, some of them anyway. So please do feel free to put me in my place or question what I'm saying, because I really would like this to be a bit of a moment for that. I'm open to it. I'm not afraid of criticism. Do I point it at that or that?
I think, yeah, just point it at the screen. I think.
There.
Yeah, for the. Yeah.
Okay, anywhere, I guess. So key themes for today that I'm going to address is governance and what I mean by governance, power, what I mean by power, and the different forms of power, and how power is tending to lead towards violence and threats, what I'm calling kind of beyond power in the Amazon at the moment. So this is drawing on, as Connie said, I've been working in the Amazon region since 2000, originally looking more at trees and then transitioning into communities and transitioning into politics and policy making at a larger scale. So I'm drawing on bits and pieces throughout my history of work there. I'm not going to go into too much detail on the methods. Happy to discuss them afterwards if anyone has questions about any of the things that I present. We all know where the Amazon is, I hope. and we see scenarios of expanding deforestation across different frontiers and a lot of attention as to what needs to happen to put a brake on deforestation. Brazil was in the news quite a lot as the test case or the positive outcomes case, not so much recently. So we've seen a shift maybe from command and control towards carrots and sticks, but it's not working, and deforestation still continues. And so this is the sort of question that I have, not governing Amazon for health or other aspects of governance, but really focusing more on forest use, land use change, and from more of an equity and justice perspective. And I just want to make sure that we're thinking about the Amazon as a complex system and not just as forest and not just as communities and not just as individual policymakers, but that this is part of the challenge, is that these systems are so complex, and when you poke over here, it may have implications over here, and we really don't know what's going to happen and what are the expected outcomes often of our actions. And so, again, just keeping that in mind, this is a policy network of the interactions amongst different actors in red in Peru, as an example, but just to get our minds into the complex webs of interactions that are going on. And also, I'm taking this in a lens of what needs to happen for change towards sustainable development, change towards keeping the forests as forests and keeping the people fed and healthy and having decent standards of living. And so that's where I'm aiming, I think what a lot of us are aiming for, and that's what needs to happen for that to really occur. To start off, talking about governance, power, and beyond power. So what am I talking about when I talk about governance? particularly forest governance, a definition by Connie, and not just because she's in the room, that forest governance is the deliberate institutionalized steering of forest use and conservation, but also other definitions that it talks about, the norms, processes, instruments, people, and organizations that control how people interact with forests. So I come from a forestry background, I come from a forestry lens, but also thinking about that more broadly in terms of other definitions that include natural resource governance. But again, these come back over and over again to the themes of who decides, what are the decisions that are being made, and how are they implemented, and also what are the outcomes that those decisions are having. I've done some work looking at forest governance monitoring and how, where are we in the Amazon region in terms of the quality of the governance that is out there. And again, just to think, whoops, whoa, sorry. just to think about the principles of good governance, so accountability, effectiveness, efficiency, fairness, equity, participation, transparency. There are other frameworks that look at different principles, but these are broadly the kinds of things that I've been looking at, and within these different pillars, policies, legal, institutional, and regulatory frameworks, the planning and the decision-making processes, and the implementation or the enforcement, so how much is that actually happening. And we did a benchmarking study in 2014 in Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. I won't go into detail, but just to say that all of these countries, there's a lot to be done. They're not on the worst case scenario end of the spectrum. Some of the laws that are in place are, at least in theory, good laws. If they were implemented, things might work. So there's different problems along that spectrum, but that things aren't as bad as perhaps they could be in the Amazon region. And again, just going back to the complex systems, it's not just about forests. For a long time, we've seen different actors within the development scene, within academia, talking about integrated conservation and development. How can we bring environmental and pro-poor objectives to the same type of interventions or projects? Those kind of went out of fashion, although they're still being implemented. So I think in academia they went out of fashion, but actually in practice they're being implemented to this day, just with different names. And a lot of people think that RED is just another integrated conservation development project. And then Ostrom came out with the social ecological systems framework, which again is looking at these complex systems and interactions among them. And then maybe more recently, maybe not, landscape approaches that have been talked about quite a lot in terms of, again, thinking at about the problems at a landscape scale. And there was a systematic review of this that came out last year that gives a bit more of a background about what that means and what it has meant and what it should mean. But that it's not necessarily new to think about this as more than just forests, and I'm not saying it is, but I just want to drive that point home that we really can't think about just what's happening to the forests if we're going to keep them standing. And because they are such complex systems, it is like a bicho de sete cabeças. It's a seven-headed beast. It's a problem with no real simple solution. And if we look, for example, at governance in Peru, we've got the government, but it's got multiple heads. And I was actually quoted by Al Jazeera saying that the government of Peru is two-headed, which was maybe not what I was aiming to have myself cited for, but there really are essentially multiple heads at the same table with multiple perspectives and objectives and power within that for who gets to really decide about what's happening. And it's not just the national, it's the subnational and the local level. So again, multi-level governance, thinking about not just a decision made at the local level or at the international level, but all of these things are interacting across space and time. And again, just as an example of how complex these systems are, you can get onto this thing still here. But looking at decision making at the landscape level in Madre Dios in Peru, this study by some colleagues at Seafloor was looking at, okay, who do you need to go to make a decision? And you can see this really complex web. If you're a local farmer and you need land and you want land title, it's not that simple. You don't just go to one person and get it resolved. So I'm thinking about all of these things, all of these complex interactions and these actors that are at different levels and have different perspectives and different interests across this stage. And so it's bringing me over and over and over again to these questions of power. And there are different definitions of power out there, and I will not go into all of the philosophy behind power, but this one perhaps helps. It's a chance of a man or a number of men or women to realize their own will even against the resistance of others for participating in a given action. There has been a history of considering power as just the ability to act, and others consider it just not just the ability but the right to act. But more importantly, perhaps, is that there is not just one type of power, there's not just one powerful actor in any scenario, and as you know, Foucault says, power is everywhere, it's coming from everywhere, it's going to everywhere, and we have to think about it not just as this one entity that we can control and measure necessarily. And in thinking about natural resources and power, this definition of access and bundles of power by Ribot and Peluso, I think, is really helpful, that one individual may hold a bundle of powers whose strands include various means of controlling and maintaining access. This person will be in a dominant position with respect to some actors and in a subordinate position to others. And again, I think that this question of who has access to the land, who has access to the resources, is not so simple, in that you may be the government and you can dictate that a given community, for example, does not have access, but actually they go and they use it anyway. So they do have the power to access those resources. And so when I'm starting to deconstruct these questions of who has power and who doesn't, these are the things that I'm starting to think about and bring to the table. And one thing that I've been using to understand these dynamics as we move towards not just being individuals with power, but groups that have power to act and to put pressure on the system in a given direction, is the advocacy coalition framework, which essentially says that actors from different public and private organizations can share a set of beliefs and seek to realize common goals. They can form a coalition and essentially work together to fight for that end goal because they hold beliefs in common. Now, there's quite a lot of literature out there, again, that I won't necessarily go into, but the sense that we may form coalitions based on our beliefs, but in some cases it may actually be in our best interest to group up with somebody who doesn't necessarily agree with us on everything, but may agree with us on a particular angle or a particular position that we have when faced with a given problem. And that these advocacy coalitions form power by bringing together the resources of all the different individuals and organizations within that coalition. And the different types of power that we're talking about are legal authority. So are they state actors? Are they non-state actors? Or do they have some legal authority over decision-making regarding a given resource? Access to information. This goes back to this, you know, knowledge is power, information is power. If you hold the information, you can make these decisions. Is there a pool of people and institutions who can be rallied to support the policy change? So how many institutions are on board? How many individual people are willing to come to that meeting? You know, those questions are really just power in numbers. Financial resources, so you have the money. Money is power. And skillful leadership. Again, you're not going to get anywhere without individuals at the front who are able to lead that coalition in their actions. And so I'm starting to look at these in different scenarios as the resources that these coalitions
need to work towards change.
I'm presenting a little bit on some work that is still being finalized on policy network analysis of RED in Peru. And again, it's looking at these advocacy coalition frameworks and resource dependency theory. So these resources, so the ability to access these resources is really going to determine your decision-making as an organization or an individual in terms of who you join or which coalition you form. And that if you have a change in the resources, like something like RED, which at least in theory can bring quite a lot of financial resources or attention to a given cause, you can shift the dynamic of who teams up with who, and potentially increases overlapping interest groups. And what we found, in this case, we said, okay, we've got green actors who are essentially working towards green issues, not just environmental, but sort of more broadly human rights and equity issues. Growth actors who are interested much more in more traditional neoliberal approaches to growth, and then some actor categories who are more in the both. And the point here is much more just that you see within this scenario over discussions about REDs that they are actually talking to each other. And they're not talking, the growth actors don't really talk to each other about RED because it's not really in their interest. But within the green actors, you have quite a lot of interactions and information seeking. And there is some dissemination of information across these different groups. So there's a little bit of hope there that as these actors are interacting and exchanging information, that there may be some changes in discourse within the given organizations. But what we also looked at is reputational power. And again, this is power beyond just a state versus a non-state actor. In the field, when you ask a lot, often when I've asked people what is power, they talk about, you know, the politician who's in charge or the head of the ministry. Those are the powerful players. But actually, it's beyond that, and that perceptions of an actor's power can also give that person the power to influence where things go. And again, back to this, that knowledge is power, and that social norms are also going to influence who you perceive as powerful. It's not just that they have the legal authority over you, but perhaps they're your grandmother or they're an expert in the field, and you will give them a sense of power, a reputational power, and you will turn to those actors in a case where it might not be just about they can say yes or no. Sorry, my computer froze when I was fixing this slide, so this is why. But so knowledge is power. In terms of information sharing, we ask the individual organizations, who do you consider important for RED in Peru, as an example? And there was a correlation between reputational power and whether or not the number of actors who asked you for information, less so of the power and who they sought information from. Money is power, not really. And actually, it was a statistically insignificant and not negative relationship between the budget of a given organization and its reputational power within RED. So the powerful players, at least in the perceptions of reputational power, were not necessarily the ones who had all the money. And I also see, again, linking this back to these questions of information sharing and communication across these groups, that discourse is a form of power. And when we turn to Brazil, as things have been changing in recent years, you have a discourse amongst some of the actors at the national stage and the local stage that, you know, there's too much land for too few Indians, and we need to take back that land. Really a discourse towards powerful players getting back the land that they need to produce for Brazil. And perhaps linked to that, and also you have a relaxing of the forest code. And Brazil has been the number one culprit in violence against environmental defenders in the last, definitely this past year, definitely in 2014. I can't remember what the status was in 2015, but not doing very well in terms of the manifestation of that discourse on the ground. And the changes in these policies, essentially they relaxed the forest code, going back to and giving amnesty to actors that had deforested beyond what was legal up until 2008. And again, it's this change in what you say is acceptable and then what ends up happening on the ground. In Peru, what the government says, you have it. Ooh, sorry, I keep pressing the wrong button. Okay. You have a commitment to zero net deforestation by 2021, a pact to eliminate illegal logging, an agreement with Norway and Germany for performance-based payments for RED, all in the context of continued deforestation. Big economic players are really quite active on the scene. And I want to talk about, again, because we kind of come back a lot to the big players and the powerful players, and that money is power. And gold mining in Peru is perhaps one of the powerful examples of that. In recent years, the price of gold increased, the mining area has increased. In response to that, there was an initiative by some players on the national scene to control the gold mining, to fight against the illegal miners. And you had situations where they were blowing up mining equipment, but you also had really quite a lot of violent conflict between the government and and the miners in the field. And what we saw was, while one head, this is kind of what sparked my two-headed comment back in 2014, is that you have one head of the government, the sort of more environmental green coalition, trying to control the mining, trying to really put environmental controls in place, and then you have the mining ministry coming from a very different perspective and being pro-mining and not really trying very hard at all to control things. And so you see, this is recent results from Peru, you have an expansion of the mining. So they have absolutely they really have no control over what's going on. And they have not managed to get it under control. And the pictures, if you put in gold mining Peru and look at some of the images that you can see, it looks like it's been bombed. In certain patches of Madrid, that's where this is happening. So in this case, there are players on both sides and there are coalitions on both sides fighting for change and fighting for control and fighting for implementation of the law. But money is winning, and the drive for gold and the drive for money is winning. But this also comes within discourse about alternative livelihoods in Peru, kind of blaming coca for, and this is something that Aoife can talk about much, much better than I can, but I just, again, another example about, we see coca as cocaine as the enemy, and we need to find sustainable alternatives for these communities that are growing coca. And that then gets replaced with oil palm, as a solution, but actually, some studies have shown that the coca growing is really happening around failed settlement projects, and so it's not. It's again, it goes back to the history of what the decisions that were made about land use and who has the power and where those people end up, and that actually, coca as a driver of deforestation is not on the same scale as legal agricultural crops. So blaming coca is really not working, and at the same time, oil palm is increasing.
I want to talk a little bit what is happening, and I've touched on it a little bit in some of this. When we move beyond power, because I think power implies a certain degree of free will, and again, some of the literature on power and the discourse around power talks about this, but there has to be some free will on both sides for it to be power, and it becomes really more domination and coercion when there is no choice in the matter. and back in June, we had OCTF helped co-sponsor a workshop or conference for forest defenders who have been threatened with violence, and some of you I recognize were there. And one of the things that we think about is that within this context of violence against environmental defenders is really, you're looking at scenarios where there's a strong incentive, whether it be by the government or private actors, to exploit those resources. But the people who are dependent on the resources tend to be marginalized in some way, but also that the conflicts are happening in countries where the rule of law is really weak. And this is based on the talk that John Knox gave at that conference. And again, highlighting, okay, how violent is a certain situation? Brazil, there were 47 environmental or land defenders killed in 2016. Colombia is in second place, not a very good place to be, with 37, I think, or 36. Peru had 2 that year, and the other countries are highlighting Central America and some other countries. But so the situation is not good for environmental defenders in Peru and in Brazil. And just this year, there was a massacre in Pará of land rights defenders. Again, this was communities that had moved into an area, and they were not murdered by private actors. There was involvement of the national military police. And those people were recently let go. And in Peru, six people were murdered over land conflicts in September. These are just examples. We can't go into all the details, but I just want to highlight that people are dying over these power conflicts, over these beyond power. It's an attempt to dominate. It's an attempt to move beyond a question of free will. Can we negotiate to a question of coercion and dominance through fear? And what do you do when this is happening in countries with high rates of corruption? So again, this is Transparency International's corruption perceptions indices. And for the Amazon region, and I think actually the numbers, so the higher the better in this case. Peru at 35, Brazil at 40, and I question this 40, it's at a national level, and perhaps if we start to look at what the corruption rates are in the Amazon, both for Peru and for Brazil, they're not going to be nearly as good in terms of the level of corruption that's going on the ground. So this corruption is leading to links between the national parties and the private sector actors who are involved in environmental crimes. And so this is from some work done by Ojo Público in Peru, where they've connected who was giving money to the national party. And you can see the number of actors who have been accused of environmental crimes up here. This is narco, drug crimes. For environmental crimes, you can see the number of links, donations to politicians within these national parties. And so, the power of what they want is obviously infiltrating up into the national national politicians who are then making those decisions and making things like the gold mining continue, making sure that different policies are enacted at the national stage. And again, is power... But if power is... If money is power, sometimes... power is being used also to... Money is being used to fight for avoided deforestation. However, this then gets into questions of sovereignty, which is one of the big issues that Brazil has been bringing to the table around things like RED and international funding. And this also, the framing of this in the international media is saying that Norway is issuing a threat to Brazil over rising deforestation, and actually this was part of an agreement for performance-based payments. So this is not really a threat. It's saying we're not going to pay you if you don't do what you said you were going to do. But we can take these discourses, again, to communicate a message to change how people view the situation. Does change require disasters? A couple days ago, Duncan Green has been talking quite a lot from Oxfam, has been talking quite a lot about how change happens, and that do you need a disaster in order for any of these power dynamics to really change? And there was a recent blog about this and about the in order for inequality to change, in order for power dynamics to change, something quite significant has to happen. And that goes back a bit to what I was talking about on a much smaller scale with the resource dependency theory and changes in coalitions. You gotta some kind of a shock to the system to make things change. And I don't mean to end on the on the four horsemen of the apocalypse, but that things right now, I think that the power dynamics in the Amazon are not going in the right direction, and I think that we have an influx of interest. Well, there has always been interest in the Amazon from outside, but now there's a little bit more money. But if we think about the money that Norway and Germany are putting in, it's $300 million. For Peru, for example, that pales in comparison to what's coming out from the mining sector. And so we say that the money can solve the problem, but I really don't believe that. And I'm looking for the answer as to what the other sort of shift will be or needs to be in order for these power dynamics to change, in order for governance to move in the right direction, and then hopefully we can avoid these horsemen. Thanks.